Anthony Arnoff.
I think that if you look around the world today, there's probably no issue or no foreign policy issue, certainly, that's more misreported and distorted in its reporting than what's happening in Iraq. And I think Howard gave an excellent context for beginning to peel away the media distortions of explaining how we got into the situation of the Gulf War and to now 10 years of the most comprehensive sanctions that the United Nations has ever imposed at the behest of the United States. And I think there's really so many examples of this, but I think one of the most common and disturbing ones is that if you pick up a newspaper or listen to a newspaper article talking about Iraq, it's as if there's only one person who lives in that country. The country has a population of one. His name is Saddam Hussein. You may have heard of him. He's a very bad guy. We can all recite the list of his crimes, although, of course, we're not supposed to talk about the fact that many of those crimes were undertaken using biological, chemical weapons capacity that was developed when Hussein was an ally of the United States during the 1980 to 1988 Iran-Iraq War. We're not supposed to know that in March 1988, when the Iraqi government gassed Kurds in the town of Halabja, killing perhaps 5,000, that crime was committed with the full knowledge of the United States, no repercussions for Saddam Hussein or his government. In fact, that gassing was soon followed by a visit of senators, including Bob Dole, to reassure Saddam Hussein of friendly relations with the West, and was also followed by an extension of agricultural credits and discussions between the Bush administration, the Iraqi Business Forum, and Saddam Hussein about how the United States could continue to do business with Iraq. And the reality of the matter is that although the sanctions are described as targeted towards Saddam Hussein, targeted towards Iraq, the Iraqi government, nothing could be farther from the truth. I was really struck by an editorial that the Boston Globe ran recently. It was on the occasion of the death of Hafez al-Assad, the Syrian dictator. And the Boston Globe pointed out that justifiably, Hafez al-Assad had many crimes to his name, but they came to his defense in one area, which was that he had a feud with the faction of the Ba'athist Party in Iraq that's headed by Saddam Hussein. In the article, had a very instructive sentence. I'll just read it. It said, "The impulsive, impatient Saddam was driven out of Kuwait and suffered sanctions for a decade," in referring to Saddam Hussein. But the reality is Saddam Hussein has not suffered the sanctions, and it was the Iraqi army that was driven out of Kuwait, and it was the Iraqi army that, as Howard pointed out, was slaughtered as it was retreating. And if you look at the May 23rd New Yorker, there's an article by Seymour Hersh in which he points out that Barry McCaffrey, the current drug czar in the Clinton administration, who's heading up the attack on African Americans and Latinos and working class people in this country in the name of the war on drugs, who's also heading up the expansion of the U.S. military into Colombia and the destruction that that's entailing, that 2 days after the ceasefire ended the Gulf War, Barry McCaffrey led an assault on retreating Iraqi soldiers, a slaughter that Seymour Hersh has since exposed. So when I was in Iraq in March with the Fellowship of Reconciliation and Voices in the Wilderness and toured parts of the country, visited schools, visited hospitals, neighborhoods, internally displaced persons camps, it's very clear, and I think it's clear to any observer, that the embargo has not impacted the government, it's not impacted the military elite, it's not impacted business people with foreign business connections. It's hurting ordinary people in Iraq, the 22 million people of Iraq whose water system has been destroyed, whose education system has been destroyed, whose economy has been destroyed, and whose lives are being shattered by the embargo and the ongoing environmental and social damages caused by the Gulf War and the ongoing bombing of that country. The elite in Baghdad have had a boom in private pool construction in Iraq during the last 10 years. There are BMWs, Mercedes-Benz, sports utility vehicles that people allied with Saddam Hussein and his cronies are driving around Baghdad. The elite have chlorine for their private swimming pools, while the UN sanctions are keeping out the water pumps and the chlorine and the chlorinators that are necessary to treat water in Iraq. And what that means is that under 5 deaths in children, the leading cause now is diarrhea, dehydration caused by diarrhea. Diseases, classic diseases of third world poverty, which had been largely eliminated by 1989 or 1990 in Iraq, if not sooner, are now widespread throughout the population. Kwashiorkor, forms of malnutrition, cholera, and other waterborne diseases, because the water treatment system in Iraq has been systematically undermined, and Iraq has not been able to adequately rebuild it so that people, you know, you hear when people talk about Iraq, they talk about biological weapons. The water in Iraq has become a biological weapon. The sanctions are a weapon of mass destruction in Iraq. The UNICEF, United Nations Children Fund, did a systematic study throughout the country in which they surveyed homes all around the country, weighed children, studied infant mortality rates, compared them to Iraqi standards before the imposition of sanctions in the Gulf War, compared them with international standards, and they discovered a doubling of under 5 infant mortality in Iraq. In a population of 22 million people over 10 years, they estimate that translates into 500,000 excess deaths. And that's just children under 5 mortality. That's not the suffering of those who's surviving, the stunting, the malnutrition. It's not the impact on the adults, the families who are losing their children, the families who are unemployed, the families who can't send their children to school, but who have to send them out into the streets to try to beg, to piece together some kind of existence. So the sanctions aren't targeting the regime. They're not targeting Saddam Hussein. In fact, as many of the authors of Iraq Under Siege, the anthology I edited, point out, it's actually in many ways strengthened the regime and undermined opportunities for any kind of democratic change there. I think another aspect of this story, and Howard touched on it, it's very important, is the ongoing bombing of Iraq. You know, sanctions are presented in the media as an alternative to war, as a means short of war. And yet, at times on an almost daily basis, it's now happening somewhat less regularly, Iraq has been bombed by British and American planes flying over these areas of Iraq that are called no-fly zones. There's no UN resolution which established these, despite claims that you often hear in the media, although I don't think they have any more legitimacy in that case. But the United States and Britain, taking off from bases in Turkey, are routinely bombing in Iraq. And when I was in Basra in March, I went to a residential neighborhood called Al-Jumariya. Al-Jumariya, for blocks around, is nothing but homes, clinics, schools, neighborhood shops, newsstands, no military facilities. And on January 19th, 1999, the United States dropped cluster bombs on a residential neighborhood in Al-Jumariya. I visited the home of a woman named Iqbal Fartous. Iqbal Fartous no longer goes by that name, however. She now goes by the name Haider, meaning mother of Haider, because on that day, she not only lost 11 of her neighbors, she lost her son, Haider. And as she told us this story, she called in her son, Mustafa, who's around 5 years old, and she asked Mustafa to pull up his shirt and to pull down his pants so that we could see throughout his body, underneath his skin, the visible shards of cluster bomb and the debris from that bombing. And of course, because of the state of the medical infrastructure in Iraq, he can't receive the kind of proper medical treatment he needs for that traumatic and horrible damage to his body and to his life. But Haider told us this story because she wanted people in the United States to hear it, and she had the confidence that if people did know what was going on in Iraq, they would not stand for it, and they would join the movement to end the sanctions on Iraq, and they would take action. And I think that that's absolutely correct, and we've seen growing signs that the movement to end sanctions is reaching a critical mass, is reaching more and more people, and is having an impact. The United States is on the defensive on the sanctions policy. The United Nations is on the defensive. Kofi Annan, the Secretary General of the United Nations, in April said, "We're losing the propaganda war over sanctions." The Clinton administration recently has said a number of things very defensively about the sanctions, responding to the critics, to activists who have put this on the agenda at a time when George Bush and Al Gore are actually calling for a tightening of the sanctions. The only person who's running in the current campaign who's talking about this is Ralph Nader. And I'm very pleased to say that on August 6th, the 10th anniversary of sanctions, there was a national demonstration, the first of its kind, calling for an end to the sanctions. People marched in torrential rain in Washington, D.C., and Ralph Nader was out there on August 6th, and I think we should be out there October 1st for Ralph Nader. When Madeleine Albright went to the University of California at Berkeley in May to receive an honorary degree at the commencement address, they actually had to completely rework the program at UC Berkeley and shuttle Madeleine Albright out because there were protesters in the auditorium, there were protesters outside the auditorium. 59 people were arrested for disrupting that ceremony. There was a plane flying above Berkeley with carrying the banner, "End the Iraq Sanctions Now," that she would have seen as she came out through the protest. And they pulled her out very early, not just because of concerns that she would see more of the protest, but because Fadia Rafidi, the undergraduate who received the highest honors from the university, was the founder of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee chapter at Berkeley, and they were concerned that she would give a speech denouncing sanctions, which is exactly what Fadia Rafidi did. And then Madeleine Albright was met with protests the following week at George Washington University and here at Northeastern University in Boston when she tried to give a commencement address. Even mainstream media sources now have come out against sanctions. Today's Chicago Tribune, The Economist magazine, The Financial Times. I encourage you to check out the current issue of the U.S. News and World Report. It's the college issue where you're supposed to determine which Ivy League school to send your children to. And there's a very powerful article about life in Iraq, and it says very clearly, the United States government insists that the sanctions only are targeted at the government, and that is not the case. They are only hurting the ordinary people of Iraq. And this is a growing movement that is reaching more and more people and that I really encourage you to be part of. There's a number of groups who are doing work around the sanctions issue, the Fellowship of Reconciliation, the American Friends Service Committee, the International Socialist Organization, Voices in the Wilderness, Boston Mobilization for Survival, and increasing coordination between these groups to get into churches, to get into unions, to get into communities, and to encourage the kind of protest that can raise the cost of this policy for the United States. There's clearly an urgency to ending the sanctions on Iraq. At the current projections, 5,000 more children a month will die in Iraq under five if the embargo continues. A generation is being destroyed. Prospects for the country's future are being destroyed. The history of Iraq is being destroyed. And there's also very important connections between what the United States is doing in Iraq and what it's doing in Colombia and what it's doing elsewhere around the world, and ultimately connections between that and the fact that there's 44 million people who are uninsured in this country while the United States is spending money and weapons to maintain bases in the Middle East and keep hospitals and schools from being rebuilt in Iraq. And I think those are very important connections for us to draw and to connect up with those forces in the Nader campaign, connect up with those forces who are in Prague this week, in Seattle, in Washington, who are questioning the cost of U.S. empire, and to end U.S. empire if we can.
Thank you, Anthony Arnov. Please welcome Dr. Noam Chomsky.